And good evening, everyone. Good evening from Japan, but it may be good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. Welcome to the teacher's room at ITDI, the International Teacher Development Institute. We're very thrilled to be able to meet with teachers every Tuesday night, Japan time, and Saturday mornings, to either talk with teachers in general or to have a special guest. And tonight we have a special guest, Mr. Vance Will Stevens. How did Williams almost came out? Vance Stevens. Wow. So, Vance, welcome. And we want to just tell everybody that we're here just to get to know you and to share some ideas about teaching and about learning. And our setup is usually just a free-for-all. I'll lead with questions, and everybody else can just jump in. So, welcome, Vance. How are you feeling tonight?
Well, just fine. Had a nice walk. Didn't rain. It's kind of boiling over clouds, thunder and things like that, but managed to escape the rain.
Now, where are you talking to us from tonight?
Penang, from Penang, Malaysia, not far from Phil. And yeah, I moved here a year ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when I was working in the UAE up till I was for about 20 years actually, and then popped out the top, so ended up here. My son married a Malaysian girl, so we got a Malaysia, my second home visa, so it was a logical place to come.
Cool. Well, I hope that it'd be really fun if the three or even the four of us, if Mike gets over as well, get together and sit and drink some iced tea together somewhere. That would be a very nice afternoon in my
Yeah,
home.
Michael said he was looking at trying to get to Malta next year, 2020. So let's
What's
keep an eye on
Malta,
that.
Bill?
The Malaysian English Language Teaching Association International Conference is in August every year.
In August, yeah. Yes.
Mm.
Well, I'd like to get over to that as well.
Oh,
So,
definitely.
I sent you a short list of questions that we have just as a standby, but a good place to start is for you to take as much time as you like to introduce yourself and tell us how you got here to where you are today, your teacher's journey.
Yeah, it's a long story.
Well, you've got an hour, Matt.
Okay, well, basically, I got a degree in biology from the University of Houston. And when I left there, I got my degree, I got a job as a purchaser somewhere. And I worked for a couple of years there to earn enough money to set myself free. And then I went traveling for a couple of years, hitchhiking. Started in Europe, went through the Middle East, and
What year might this be that you were hitchhiking through Europe and the Middle East?
73, 4, and 5, I believe. So it was
Wow.
a 2-year trip.
Wow.
And I returned to Houston in 75 or 74. No, 74, I think. And I wanted to continue traveling. That's the one thing I knew I wanted to do, is I wanted to keep traveling. And but I didn't want to be wondering where my next meal was coming from. I wanted to sort of support myself somehow doing that. So I went over to the University of Houston, where there's an English language services. And I walked in and I spoke to somebody and said I wanted to teach English. He said, "Oh, okay, come back tomorrow." So I did. And the next day I walked in, they said, "Well, your class is over there." I said, What am I supposed to do?" And they said, "Oh, well, they sent someone to tell the class to chill for a while." Well, they talked to me. They gave me the 1 hour MA basically. And then after that, I knew what to do. So I went in and I started doing it. And I did that for a couple of years, I guess. And then in 1976, I went to the TESOL conference in New York. And I spoke to people in Saudi Arabia who were thinking I should really get an MA, and maybe they weren't really interested in, I didn't have the skills. But somebody back there was desperate as well, and so they actually sent me an offer, and I accepted. So I ended up in Saudi Arabia for the next 5 years.
Wow.
I guess the really,
With just the BA at that point, yeah?
yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But I went from there to get an MA, but before I went there, they had somebody put a computer terminal down in the language center, and it was just sitting there, and one day I went over and I just started messing around with the keyboard. And my director walked by and he saw me doing that. And he thought, well, I must know something. So he put me in charge of the computer-assisted instruction, they called it back then, facility. So I would be heading a team of teachers who would be developing drill and practice activities on this thing. We didn't really know what we were doing, but I read a manual. I was always a day ahead in the manual than anybody else. And so when someone had questions, I was usually able to answer them and basically put that thing together. But in a couple of years, I was gone. I was in Hawaii and I was getting my MA there. Right. And I did a
Was that a University of Hawaii?
Yeah, University of Hawaii at Manoa. Really lovely place.
A good place, good program, everything.
Yeah. Yes, excellent program. Yeah, so I was doing an MA. My thesis was on research into some aspect of computer-assisted language learning. And they had a TESOL conference there as well. And the people back then, there weren't that many people into computers, and we sort of banded together. And they invited me to a symposium next year where they were actually getting more people involved in setting up an interest section in TESOL, they thought. So I went there, and one thing we did, John Higgins suggested we call it not CAI, but CAL. He thought we should emphasize learning. I actually argued against him at the time because I thought that's traditionally a CAI, that's all the literature I was reading, but he was quite right, and he won out. He won the day, so it became a computer-assisted language learning interest section. Hi, Mike. How you doing? And they elected someone to be the chair for next year, and they were looking for an assistant chair. So John Higgins refused it, and Graham Davies refused it, and the next person refused it. They kind of got down to the small people around, and I got stood up against somebody else to become elected the assistant chair. But then the chair bowed out for personal reasons, and I became, to make a long story short, the next year the chair of the computer-assisted language learning interest section, the first one. So we put that on through. Meanwhile, I graduated from the University of Hawaii. I went over to the Big Island of Hawaii. I set up a program there for English language EFL students at this Hawaii Preparatory Academy, which was a college where the foreign Japanese people, Chinese people, et cetera, were sending their kids there.
Yeah.
And mainly because they couldn't handle at home, you know, so they sent them to me.
Right.
But I had to make sure they could learn English. And I got the Hawaii Preparatory Academy to buy some Apple computers.
Oh, wow.
And but because we were all kind of naive, no one thought to budget for software. So we got the computers. And when I said, well, what can I spend for software? They said, nothing. There's nothing budget. So I had to learn BASIC. And I sort of adapted some kind of text manipulation stuff that was freeware, public domain software. Put together a program. That was part of it. But that's by then I was publishing some things, and I was still going to TESOL conferences. And
was that the time of still a lot of drilling and kind of that was that the era of drilling with the language labs, and were you getting beyond that yet?
I think at the University of Hawaii they were getting beyond that. They were into process and student-centered community language learning, things like that. So no, we're sort of moving out of that.
Right.
But
in Japan here, when I went into high school in the late 80s, we walked into a $100,000 computer language lab that nobody knew how to use. And there was a big wave of those all over Japan that huge budget went into this, thinking it was the silver bullet of learning language.
And back then there was a Plato system from the University of Illinois, I think, or Champaign, or was it in Champaign or Benno? Anyway, I don't know. Do you remember Plato at all?
Just the name.
I did a review of English language learning lessons on it, but I also took, you had to take a foreign language at the University of Hawaii, and I took Japanese.
Oh.
And the reason I took Japanese was because there was a guy at the University of Hawaii who was making lessons on Plato. So here we had people who had kind of progressive ideas and making some things. Drill in practice was actually quite useful in learning kanji, not kanji, but the hiragana, katakana, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I probably couldn't have learned it without this rote.
I would argue that there's still part of that with vocabulary learning. There's a certain amount of pain you just need to get through, you know, and flashcards and review and,
Yeah. Actually, with Minecraft, I'm editing a Tesla EJ, Tesla Electronic Journal. I'm the editor of the On the Internet column, and I just edited an article that was written by some lady who has been studying the vocabulary that comes up in Minecraft, not just in the game itself, but also in the videos that people tend to watch to learn how to do that. And they're actually picking up higher vocabulary and higher for the nation's 14K word lists. They're picking up vocabulary at a higher level when you put students, she put a couple of students in gameplay mode and then had them talk through what they were doing, and their vocabulary was much higher. They were kids. So it was much higher than you would expect. But the reason she says, which I agree, is that you're recycling this vocabulary, or as Folsom says, you retrieve it. Yep. So the retrieval rate is very high, because it's good to get into situations where you're encouraged to retrieve, you know, not just with flashcards and things, but, you know, if you can actually find a situation that forces you or makes you want to retrieve vocabulary, then that's a nice approach to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically,
we're in Hawaii.
I was leaving Hawaii, heading for Oman. That was my next job. I mentioned that I'd got publications.
It's funny because you've said UAE and Oman now and Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Were you destined to end up in the Middle East, or was that just by coincidence or timing?
Well, I think I'm from Texas, and there's a lot of oil there, and it seems that actually a lot of my jobs, I mentioned I was a purchaser. That was for a company that made seismic equipment. So a lot of my jobs have been peripherally associated with oil. That's not really my focus, but still, these countries are oil producers. They have money, and for someone who doesn't have an MA, it was a good place to go. And then in Oman, they were building a university there, so I was attracted to that. And when I left Oman 10 years later, I went to work for a software company, and that company was in California. And then when I left there, I went back. I went to the UAE again because there was somebody offering a decent contract to do interesting work, to build a military language institute.
Wow!
But that's and I was a consultant on that, and also in charge of the computer-assisted language learning tie-in with the academic program.
And this all goes back to you sitting down in front of a computer one day and somebody walking by.
Yeah, there you go. Well, kind of, yeah. But there's something else in there that I'd kind of like to dwell on a little bit, and that is that when I went to California after 10 years in Oman and 5 years in Saudi Arabia and a couple of years before that, I really missed teaching because I was working in software development. And I felt very cut off from that. And I kind of sought opportunities to do that. And what was coming up at the time was online learning.
Oh.
So there was a guy there named Dave Wynette. He's still there, and he was in Berkeley. And
what year are we in now?
I left Oman in 1995. So, okay. And I worked for the software company until 97. So I was there for 2 years.
Yep.
And somewhere in there, 96 maybe, I got involved with this guy who had something called study.com. And study.com was basically a web page he'd set up. Students could express their interest in learning language for free. Teachers could express their interest in teaching for free. And we just kind of learned how to deal with one another. The first kinds of lessons back then were email lessons, which I discovered quickly that students loved to write emails, but they really hated study grammar and writing and grammar is what I was teaching them. So when I went to UAE and was setting up this facility there, making a lot of the specifications for it, I had access to a LAN server, which was kind of actually a little bit unusual back then. And I had all the time internet access without having to go through the dial-up, you know, all the time. So I could sit there and hang out online. And in this way, I kind of met other students who were doing with other teachers in the study.com environment. And by then, Dave Wynette had had somebody set up a palace. I don't know if you know the palace. It's a move environment. Multi-user virtual environment.
Like a Second Life kind of.
Two-dimensional. We called it three-dimensional because you could click on a door and you could appear to go deeper into the structure, but it actually was all two. Once you got to any space, it was two-dimensional. But
a virtual world.
Yes, kind of. It was quite popular. I hung out there. I met other teachers, and we started moving the students we were accumulating in this world. By then, one of my students actually set up a web page for me, and that got me so interested in HTML. So I had learned by then to code in HTML, and I set up a web page. Actually, maybe I can even show it to you. Find it here. Yeah. Here it is. Oh. Here. Nope. Where is it? Must be. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Take your time.
Okay. I'll find it from here. Let me get back to the. Yeah. I'll share it here.
We have here Hana. Kami says.
Ah, Hana. Yeah, Hana. Hana.
Ah, there we go.
Uh-huh. And we work together. She she's the head of the PD committee in the Nile TESOL.
Oh wow!
And she does regular webinars. And she seems to quite enjoy my helping her put them out in Zoom. So that's one of the things I do with Learning Together.
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't mention that this is Learning Together episode 426 from my perspective.
Okay.
Brilliant.
We're at webheads.info right now, and I'm going to click on Writing for Webheads, which is, this is the course I set up in Learning with study.com, Dave Wynette study.com. And this is what I was doing back in 1997. Actually, I think 1998 is when we actually started learning about this. One thing I did with this is I got people to send me pictures at a time when people were not doing that.
Yeah.
It was very hard at first to get people to open the tap. But once someone agreed, someone else did. And then the next thing you know, 10 people would send you pictures.
You hit critical mass, huh?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the people sent pictures, and I put them up in this gallery. And this gallery got turns up in Second Life every now and then. And you can probably, if you just look at it, there are a lot of people who appear to be students, and then there are a lot of people who also appear to be professional teachers. Oh. So I don't know if you recognize Eric Baber down there. He was involved in this. You know Eric Baber?
I know the name.
He was head of, he was president of TESOL, I guess, or whatever you call it in TESOL. Okay. Not TESOL, IATEFL. I'm sorry.
Well,
UK based.
Yeah. So, but back then he was running a language school, an online language school, and he was interacting with people through his server, which he had set up it was a streaming server. Yep. So you didn't have an easy way to do that back then. You actually had, but you could get the software, as long as you could run it off a server, you can get the software from Microsoft. And so I got asked to go to do a plenary in Cyprus one time, and we Eric had offered somebody else on one of the lists we followed back then to make his server available for their purposes. And wow. So I picked up on that and I wrote him and said, what if we could we use it from Cyprus? Could we stream some of our plenaries from Cyprus? And he said, yeah, sure. So, well, he was already, I guess, we were already interacting with him, but he made that available. And anyway, that was just some of the connections that were going on with that group. This group was the student group. If you go to this page, just go to webheads.info, and I'm sure this is at my at Learning Together. This is Learning Together. You recognize that page? That's learningtogether.pbworks.com.
Yes. Yes.
And well, at the moment, actually, if you click on Steve and sent me a few questions in advance, you can find all the links that I'm talking about here, because I kind of wrote this out earlier today. So webheads.info is in there somewhere. And so the links are there. But basically, if you go to, I got to minimize the screen a little bit because it's running up against that little console at the top. Every time I put the mouse up there. So you can find a lot of interactions here. Here's what people were writing, for example. Someone wrote about slang. Okay, so there's a student who wrote about slang. So I was back then putting pictures against people's posts, things that they were writing. Now, this is all Web 1 stuff. The people are not writing. I'm taking their writing and I'm putting it up. It's that just wasn't, this is back in 2002, as you can see, 2000, year 2000.
Wow.
Facebook came out in
2004. Uh-huh. This is pre-Facebook.
Yeah, Martin Dujimus, I can't remember when he put out Moodle, but one of his great breakthroughs was to associate a picture with everyone's posts.
Yep. Mm.
Do you remember when Moodle came out? Was it?
Yeah.
Do you remember? Well, I don't know. I can't remember the year.
I don't know the year, but I remember,
somewhere in there. But anyway, this is all before, this is kind of a Facebook for you know, EFL people. But the problem,
Facebook,
Yes, but basically that was our idea, was to put pictures, association pictures with people and what they wrote.
I took a media course long, long ago, and they were talking about the unimaginable success of some very small newspapers throughout the Midwest in the States, or in part small communities in Canada, and that the key to the whole thing was names and faces.
Mm-hmm.
That the more names and that stuck with me in everything I've done with students, teaching, with our MASH collaboration.
Yeah, you did MASH names and faces.
Yeah, it's all names and faces. People want to be validated or recognized or listened to, or so you were you were two steps ahead of Zuckerberg.
A little bit, but I didn't capitalize on it the way he did. But
no.
We could add an ESL book, book or something like that.
Right.
But anyway, the idea is that there was some kind of profile.
Yeah.
But what happened? Meanwhile, let's see. That was in 2000. In 2001, the TESOL Call IS started something called EVO, Electronic Village Online.
Yep.
Are you familiar with that?
Sure.
Okay, so they started that in 2001. In 2002, I'd caught wind of it, and I offered to put a webheads to teach teachers how to do this. Maybe I can find a web page for that. Let's see if that's back to webheads.info. That would be the original Webheads in Action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the 2002 web ads. Basically, it has now it's more teachers. The interesting thing that happened was the teachers joined the web heads, as you saw in the other gallery that I showed you. As the teachers, they started suppressing the student voices, and the students kind of just disappeared from it. Although some of them I still know, I'm still interacting with some of those people, but the teachers, they took over that, and I made it, and that was called Webheads in Action. So it was, we were just learning about communities of practice, and we realized that we were a community of practice. This was back, I think we started that in 2002, as I said, and it's still going on.
I think that's where I first heard about you, Vance, believe it or not, and years before we ever met. And it might have been through Barb, who's in the room now, Barb Sakamoto. Mm-hmm. And I remember her talking about Evo, the Electronic Village Online, and I think it might have originally been through her. And there, Barb's now saying that's the first online course I took, Becoming a Webhead.
Yes. Becoming a Webhead was... I got interested actually in my interest in EVO turned to other things. But I got the people, there were people, Daphne Gonzalez, Teresa Almeida de Sá, I think it's her name, de Sá. Other people, maybe even Barb, possibly helped moderate those sessions. So they took the original idea, and for about 10 years they were introducing other people in this manner that I had set up, and developing communities of practice from that.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of overwhelmed by the idea of the exponential possibilities with online. Hey. It's like you said just a moment ago, you're still in touch with students that you met, you know, long, long ago, and how it's hard to actually feel the breadth of the internet. But once you get started and people know you're a good guy and you're helpful and you're open to collaboration, it's kind of endless, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's what connectivism is all about. And we sort of moved. I got very interested in connectivism. Actually, one of your questions was, "Who are my most influential teachers?"
Sure.
And
go for it.
Well, I named Jeff LeBeau, Dave Cormier, George Siemens, and Stephen Downs, and these guys. Jeff LeBeau had a community he called World Bridges. You can still find it at worldbridges.net. And he's in Korea now, and he's pretty much focused on what he calls Korea Bridges. So he had some kind of bridges for just about everything. He even hosted WebEds in Action in his Drupal for some time. Yeah. But he also had something called Webcast Academy. Webcast Academy was kind of a crowdsourced, let's all learn webcasting kind of thing. Yeah. The participants wrote a manual for it. And so we learned how to do webcasting, still back in the days when you still had to mount a streaming server somewhere. Right. And Jeff had one working. But then we moved, when you wanted to record Skype, it was very tricky. You had to get some soft cables to set up so you could record from the sound card and from the microphone at the same time. This is all pretty much built into software these days. It's much easier. But back then, we were learning about Webcast Academy, through Webcast Academy, how to do the streaming. Now, this built a bunch of people. First of all, I think Jeff is a great teacher because he was modeling all this stuff. He's very patient. And also, he was getting other people to teach themselves. And relieving himself thereby of having to teach them.
teach a man to fish analogy, hey?
Yeah, we had a community of fisher people for sure. Yeah. So we worked together in other, for example, there was Webheads in Action Online Convergences. I don't know if you know about the three Webheads in Action Online Convergences we put on. No. there was one in 2005, one in 2007, and one in 2009. Hmm. And talk about predating things. I put on these webheads in Action Online Convergences because I had a community who could do it. One guy had a Moodle server he was happy to offer us. A lady in Portugal named Fernanda made an ASP site for us, you know, ASP interface, where we could vet proposals. Actually, after 2005, the next few times, we didn't even bother to do that. We learned that people aren't going to put out, you know, say they're going to give a presentation if they're not going to deliver on it. Right. So, but this started in 2005. I don't know if you're familiar with K-12 Online.
Ah, I've heard of that, yes.
Yes, that started in 2006. Hmm. Before 2005, I was going to a lot of, not a lot of conferences, but some, but everyone required a credit card. So you had to, it just wasn't free. So, and there was one other, though, Global Learn Day, which is John Hibbs's, John Hibbs was doing something every year where he was using real audio and even telephones, POTS.
Yep, I remember that.
He was organizing every year a metaphorical ship that sailed around the world. It started somewhere and it just kept moving around the world. And he, for 24 hours, he had people involved in these programs. And that was pretty stimulating, and, yep. and that was free.
Yep.
Now, so I kind of got the idea from him, and then I did it with Webheads. And we had a three-day conference, 72 hours, you know, with
wow.
like an hour of sleep here or there.
Yep.
And George Siemens started putting on online conferences in 2007. And then, of course, in 2008, what happened in 2008? Big year.
MOOC. Oh, the crash.
No, yes, that too, yeah. But the MOOCs came about.
Oh,
so,
okay. MOOC,
yeah, so George Siemens and Stephen Downs decided they would put a course they were putting on wherever they were doing it. I can't remember. I think in Canada somewhere for sure, okay. Probably at George's institution. But they were putting on a course, and they decided to open it up to anybody for free. And they, I guess, expected like 200 people maybe.
Yeah.
They got 2,000 people. They were taken by surprise, but not unflustered by the whole thing.
Right.
That was called CCKO8, Connected and Connectivist Knowledge. 2008 was the first MOOC. Oh, no, not the first MOOC. There were other MOOCs. Somebody named Allison, I think, or there's a MOOC named Allison in UK, for example.
Yeah.
You could argue that EVO was a MOOC. But yeah. Basically, this was a connectivist MOOC. There's two kinds of MOOCs. There's connectivist MOOCs, and then the MOOCs that came along with Sebastian Thunold, was that it? You know, the edX and
yeah.
Those ones. So those are actually designed. His MOOCs, Funnel's MOOCs, were designed to teach artificial intelligence. So you actually right. had to take a course. You know, you had a program you're going to follow. It's going to teach you how to do it. So it did that, and it worked automatically. And that was what they called an X-MOOC, because there's EdX, for example.
Yep.
So, but the C-MOOCs are the MOOCs that people put together on a community.
Yeah.
And George and Stephen Downs did the first one, and Dave Cormier kind of came along and invented the term MOOC at the time.
Right.
There's some, he might be sharing that with Alexander, what it was, anyway, there's another, yeah. his yeah. last name is Alexander. Okay, so in any event, that's a detail, but Dave is widely credited with coming up with the name MOOC. Maybe I can show you another screen that I've got set up here, if I can find it over here. Let's see. Oh, share. Hit the share button. I don't know if I hit the share button the last time I did this.
You did, yep. Yep.
Oh, good. Okay. Success in the MOOC. Oh, let me just hang on a minute. Let's see. Can you hear this that I'm playing?
No.
Good. Okay. Basically, okay, well, this is Dave Cormier's MOOC. Maybe I can show you actually something else that will put it all together in one place for you. This is how we organize EVO Minecraft MOOC. So, and you see the missions there. There are five weeks, five missions.
Yep.
Orient, declare, network, cluster, and focus. So when you go to a MOOC, you orient on it because you're very confused. It's chaotic. People start writing about why they're there.
Yeah.
They start networking with other people.
Yeah.
And then they cluster. Now, that means that people with, there are 2,000 of them there. They're not all in the same room. You know, when George Siemens conceived this idea, he was thinking that in a lecture hall, he doesn't know what the students are doing there. So he actually wanted a way he could make this more individual and also remove the teacher from the process, like Jeff LeBeau did. He put it on the students. A MOOC does that. It creates a space where students can interact with each other. So
were they clustering in a number of different ways, either by topic, by country, by age, or was it defined how they should cluster?
Well, when you go to a MOOC, you can sort of try to follow it with a syllabus and go to all the events, or you can do it kind of like a berry bush. You know, there's a linear, conduit, the linear way, or the berry bush. So if you go to a berry bush, you're looking for the best berries you can reach. And if you see a berry you want, there's a thorn there, but you know, you get it out. So the berry bush is a way of accessing materials, which you just take what's there. Yep. So when you're in a MOOC, so much is going on. You don't know where the center is.
Right.
But you're starting to meet people, and you sort of you find people, and then you kind of move off into a space of your own where you're getting something out of it. You're getting out of it what you want.
Yep.
The other people who are clustered with you are doing the same. They're getting something out of it, and you could care less what's going on in the rest of the MOOC. You know, somebody's got a syllabus going or whatever. I don't know, or maybe they're giving certificates.
Corner at the big party, isn't it?
Exactly, but you wouldn't be if you didn't go to the party in the first place. You wouldn't be in the corner and meet those people who then,
right.
Because the last step is to focus. So what that does is that could go beyond the MOOC. That's where you take those people that you meet and the things that you learn from them, and you move on to something else.
Yeah, that's brilliant. The form of it is brilliant.
And just a quick question: is this mostly happening with teacher development side, or is it also things that teachers are then doing and replicating with their learners?
It could be replicated with a learner. I mean, for example, the Webheads and the Writing for Webheads course was more of a MOOC than anything else. As I mentioned earlier in the discussion, when I did an email course, it was supposed to be teaching writing and grammar. I would get to know the people, and then I'd say, okay, here's your first assignment. That would end the conversation right there. But when I set up Writing for Webheads in the space that it got set up with the pictures and everything like that, and people started sending me writing, and also we were using voice. We were putting voice plugins on our websites, and that's actually what attracted the teachers. So people were just kind of doing their thing and learning a lot of language because they're learning. I mean, someone would put out a song or send us an audio, and it was just spontaneous. It's what people wanted to do. You can go back to the webeds.info and you can look at what the students were doing because it's quite a lot is documented there. But let me go to this other page here. Oops, wrong one. This one right here. Okay, so this is something that George Siemens said. I was talking to one of the questions was about my teaching approach. Yep. And if I tell people that I'm into chaos and teaching, people say, well, you know, I don't get hired. but it's what we're talking about, though. It's you can do it linearly. Yes. Or you can sort of get people engaged in doing things. The whole Minecraft MOOC course, has actually benefits for students who engage with each other in Minecraft. They probably would do that anyway, but anyway, but the thing is if you took them to a space in your classroom where a lot of people are having really good results with that, no matter where they're teaching, but some of them are teaching languages. So let's look what George Seaman says about chaos. First of all, and this was from a video, I transcribed this from a video, that where he said, I'm not aware of any research actually that says linear structure produces better outcomes than more chaotic meandering structure. Our intent is to argue that the experience of learning, making sense of that chaos, is actually the heart of the learning experience. But if an instructor makes that sense of that chaos for you, makes sense of the chaos for you, and gives you all the reading, sets up the path for you, then you're eviscerating the learner's experience. Because now you've made sense for them, and you've told them, all you said is, just follow in the path that I've made for you. So,
Can I just do a quick analogy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, sure.
I was thinking just the other week, we're talking about learning vocabulary and textbook organization. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, a lot of textbooks may organize lexical sets for learners inside chapters and so forth. But actually, when you learn the language yourself, and then you try and figure out which words go together and which sets different words belong in, that's the work you're doing as a learner that helps you with the learning. And if that's taken away from you, you can kind of sit back and be lazy about it. So I kind of see it being an analogy for what's being said here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is not to say that you can't have a linear structure, you know. But if you're teaching in a school or online, for that matter, and people, you know, it's like when I was trying to sending people their grammar, vocabulary, grammar and writing assignments. They didn't really like that, but they loved to talk and to write and to interact with one another. You know, an authentic settings. So if you can somehow channel the things that you're trying to teach into one of those, into a more authentic setting, and getting people, you know, it could be gamification, you know, however you reach them, you could give them badges for certain things, but basically the incentive is to try to get people, when people want to learn. I suppose, actually, when you're teaching in an online space, like you're doing, you're having students who want to be where they are, because they, is that true? Yeah. So, whereas if you're teaching in school, it's not necessarily that way. But one thing I find in whatever I do with people online, normally I find people who want to be there and who want to learn and are amenable to this kind of learning. On the other hand, I've been in situations where I've been asked to do a course, let's say for TESOL, and their what do they call it, PPOT, Principles and Practices of Online Teaching. I was teaching a grab bag of people who would sign up to do the certificate course, and some people emerged through my approach having bit the Kool-Aid and have, again, remained lifelong friends. Others just didn't like it at all, you know, so, or didn't understand it. And it kind of, you know, like you say, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Yep. So maybe the students weren't ready at that time. But I think the learning, that kind of learning is very intense for people who are ready for it. And are of a disposition to make sense out of some chaos. So, but then some people like to have their hand held better. Like, it wouldn't have worked for me in the Japanese course that I was doing on Plato. And I wouldn't have had the tools to, you know, I needed just some structure to learn the katakana and hiragana. So you can't say that one approach works in all cases.
Right.
But
well, that's been the teaching methods or teaching approaches in the last 200 years. It goes from one to another, and nobody's actually learning languages any quicker. It's just because there's a wide range of, you know, methods and approaches that work for a wide range of people. Wow. I've been wrestling with that specifically on vocabulary, harking back to what Phil talked about a little while ago, but just I spent a couple of years trying to find the one approach teaching vocabulary that would work for the whole class, and it never did. I needed to have five or six choices, and then I got all the students engaged at different levels, you know.
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure you're aware of Tom Cobbs.
Yes.
Yes, his data-driven materials. Yeah.
Yep.
He used to, actually, in Oman, we shared an office.
Oh.
He was at the desk right behind me. Huh. And we were very good friends back then. And so it was, he was doing HyperCard stacks at the time and was developing his concordance programs.
Yeah.
I was doing concordancing as well. He was much more creative in the software side.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. We started in the same place, kind of. When he was in college, one of his roommates or someone in his dorm was Neil Young. So, you know, there you go. You never know who you're going to be thrown in with.
Right. So, can you believe that I'm starting to worry about the time. We're 47 minutes into this, and I got a couple of questions. I'm going to just hog the mic here for a second.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Just, before Phil and the others got here, I was saying I have a hankering to call you Shakespeare by just the prolific nature of the things you've been involved in, and good on you for saving most of it and making it still accessible. But it leads into my question about where do you sit on the whole monetizing of all of the online work that's happening these days. Some people have gotten quite rich by putting something together or packaging something, and others are pretty committed to keeping everything free forever. At ITDI, we call ourselves a social enterprise in that we are very committed to try to give everybody opportunities to improve themselves online, and so we keep all of our prices at sort of shoestring level compared to whatever is out there. But I wanted you to talk just a little bit about the whole monetizing teacher training, teacher materials, student online, and what's your philosophy on that?
Working in the Middle East, I have had the luxury of indulging my passions, and if you read what I put on that website about the time that I started getting into online teaching, that became the most important part of my life and not the teaching. Although teaching was very important, obviously I was doing jobs and good work for people and getting paid for it, but I didn't really have to worry too much about money, and I was able to do what I wanted to do. That's one thing that I like about Electronic Village Online. Oh. It's been a crucible for me. I could have ideas. Like, for example, when the MOOCs came along, I was with Principles and Practices of Online Teaching, I was asked to teach a course in multiple literacies. I taught that course for them, but it was not something I could just wind up on Sundays, as Jethro Tull used to say. It was something I had to actually do year round. And so I did it as an Electronic Village Online course for free, and then there was the aspect that both of them fed off each other. I'm certain that just as with Siemens and Downs's MOOCs, the students, the paying students, benefited from having the online students there. So. But those, with the EVO, I think the Principles and Practices of Online Teaching wanted me to do things in a certain way. That, for example, I was supposed to develop the courses in Desire to Learn, which was their right, they're paying for it. But I found it more open to me and more developing. I was myself able to develop better in EVO because I could turn the MOOCs and found out more about how they worked and decided to experiment with them myself. That's where I was able to do that. So that's just something that you know, even if you work at Google, you get a day to work on your own projects. So, so anyway, that's important. And in a way, it's kind of nice to not be, to have a job that pays, but then also be able to work on what you want to do. You know, it is very good for some people. So as far as now monetizing it, I'm not clever enough. I haven't been able to do that. And I haven't really, as I mentioned, it's had a real incentive because I'm just happy the way I am. So, however, Nelly Deutsch is doing it with something. Are you, you know, Nelly, by the way?
Yes. Yeah.
She does. I mean, she deserves it, you know, because she works really hard, and she's found a way, something she calls share to learn, I think. And she's found a way to, she monetizes that part. She was thinking, I think, to monetize other things that she's continued doing for free. A lot of the online months of, you know, a month on virtual worlds and things like that. She hasn't tried to monetize that at all, but I think that came up at some point. But basically, she definitely sees where there's something to do for free, but she's so good at Moodle that she's managed to find a way to have a monetized part. And actually,
her,
now what you're
your own niche, right?
And when I get you back to talk to me, when I get to interview you next month, we're thinking about that. I would like to find out more about how you work that social aspect,
social
where
enterprise,
for example, this one, this teacher's room actually has a price tag on it, although you can try it for free or something like that. So in a way, I think that maybe prevents people from coming here, when if it were an open space and you could just come, you know, well, you'd have to do it, you'd have to man it or staff it, you know, with people who weren't actually getting paid for that. But on the other hand, it might attract people. There's another.
We don't claim to have found the business model. And if we were in it only for that, we would have dropped it probably 3 or 4 years ago. It's sort of become a labor of love that we all work on in our free time, pretty much. We'll talk about it in more detail together next month, but by no means I don't feel very clever either right now in terms of finding the holy grail. We've always sort of been a little bit ahead of our time in things we've been doing since Phil and I have been collaborating for the past 10 years or so. So we'll get into those details when we talk next month.
I would just like to say that, you know, you have every right to earn, you know, to be paid for what you do. If you're able to do it, then that's great. And I think also,
We're really against gouging people.
Yeah.
We see some of that online, and especially because we know how much a teacher in Tunisia makes a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's just not fair to ask them to spend a month's salary on one of our courses.
Yeah. Well, IETEFL is quite interesting the way they approach this as compared to TESOL, let's say. This is one of my
me too.
Things. Yeah, because TESOL does not, TESOL sells things that, you know, they record sessions, but they sell them to you. And you get these emails all the time saying that you can buy this, you missed it, you can buy this. So you go to,
like capitalism, I would dare say.
It's TESOL Inc. is their official name. But IETEFL, on the other hand, has for the last several years been putting all their conferences, pretty much all of it, you know, certainly all the plenaries, many of the sessions, they're there. You can go and look at them. And as a result, their presenters are rock stars, because, you know, it's kind of like when if you have a radio station, you're playing music, the people who listen to music want to buy the record. If you don't play the music for free, no one's going to hear it, and they will never buy the record. So, you know, you got to do something.
They've been doing that IETEFL online since 2011. I've studied that in terms of I'm one of the co-chairs for the JOLT conference this year, and we've after many years of trying, we finally convinced them to do our plenaries, to live stream them all around the world. We have some great speakers coming, and that's completely taken from the IATEFL model. It's just goodwill and just a great idea all around.
Do you have any data as to whether it suppresses revenue or enhances revenue?
At all? No, they've said with IATEFL that they've increased their numbers. Number one, they increased their profile, and that led to, you know, you get on and watch Scott Thornbury giving a plenary, and you go, geez, I want to be there next time.
That's yes,
the effect that it has.
It really helps the network.
It creates a buzz, and people want to be where things are happening.
I'm
convinced of that.
Anyway,
you know, in my final 3 minutes with you here, this is a risky one, but the whole idea of teaching and learning, you know, you as a teacher and learning, a good portion of what you've done as a teacher has been learning. You've been on the cutting edge of lots of things, but are there any kind of big messages, big things you've learned about people, about challenging yourself, about interacting, about teaching and learning? Are there any kind of little one-liners that come to mind?
Yeah, there are. I mentioned Stephen Downs. He actually was at one of our Web as an Action online convergences. He gave a talk about learning environments or whatever. But anyway, he had a slide in his presentation which said that teachers model and demonstrate, learners practice and reflect. Those four things: model, demonstrate, practice, and reflect.
Ooh, nice.
So it just puts the whole thing into one little slide, and he's repeated that so many times. But I think he actually did it first in 2007 at our conference. Now there's another guy named Dave Warlick. Are you familiar with Dave Warlick?
No.
He has the notion of a master learner, teachers being master learners. So that is, a teacher is basically a guru who's learned, he knows how to learn, and he can now teach other people how to learn, or he can guide them into teaching them how to learn. So what does a master learner do? As a teacher should be a master learner. A master learner practices, reflects, models, and demonstrates, and percolates those things through through everything he does. And it's you know, so you've got to do all four of those things to be a master learner, and to learn and to be able to guide other people in their learning. And we haven't even talked about flipped learning yet. But
go ahead.
No, that's just...
That's too long?
Well, no, not necessarily. I see we have one more minute.
Oh, we do. Go for it. Just give it a look, because we got to chaos. You know, we spent some time on chaos, one of my notes, and the other one was flipped learning. I was just so bloody absorbed in everything the stories you were telling, I didn't bother to look down at my notes.
Well, that's okay. I mean, we could also talk about it next time we meet, but basically, it's something that I've been doing at presentations lately. I mean, first of all, the flipped learning is where you presents, you make some kind of presentation to the students or to the teacher, trainers, or whoever, of what you're going to do in the session coming up.
Yep.
And then you go there to that session with all your notes, and they have their devices, and this is it. You know, you should have seen this recording already, and if you did that, and if you did what I suggested you do, you're now in a position to carry on in this class. I'll help you with anything that you need to know. And for the others, for those of you who haven't prepared yet, well, here, this is, you should sit down and do this now, watch this, see where you're supposed to be, and if you have any questions, I'll help you. And then, of course, it's all goes into some kind of web page where people can go back and see what happened in that class, whether they were there and just didn't understand it all, or maybe they missed it. So basically, I've been doing this at presentations. When I give a presentation, I often record it maybe I'll do it, practice it on Learning Together. I'll record something, or I might just practice it right here at this desk right here and just talk it through it and make a recording in Zoom and put that on the web page and then put everything on the web page. I'll write it up the way I wrote up that thing in Learning Together right now, which is going to go to learningtogether.net. That's where you'll be able to find it when your video is ready and I put the blog up. So basically, there are no secrets for students. This came up in the EVO sessions we're setting up for teacher trainers. Do you put this in Schoology? Do you let them see all 4 weeks at once, or do you give them a week at a time? What do you think? What's your opinion?
Oh, I give them everything at once.
There you are. Exactly. Yeah. Yay. Yeah. I not only have something in common with Phil, but also with Stephen. Okay, so... Yes, exactly. That's my idea. It can't hurt to put it out there and let them read it. That's how we're talking about vocabulary. You've got to retrieve. You've got to see these things over and over again. So you put it all out there for people. Then you bring them into the space that you've contracted to be there with them. And so you can, that's their space to be one-on-one with you. And then you move it to another space, and that's where they can go back and see what they were supposed to learn. And so that's flipped learning. I do that in the presentations that I give, as I try to put everything, write it all out, make a recording, have it there. And so when I go to the presentation, I can say, look, you don't have to take notes. You don't even have to take pictures of the slides. Just go to my slides. They're right here. You just follow them as I'm talking, you know, and all the links are there. Yeah. Everything's there. Yeah.
I have one, I've said this once before, I think only, but I want to say it again. It feels like a nice follow-up. But Charles Adamson is a retired teacher here in Japan and taught for maybe 30, 40 years. And he had well and truly retired, I believe, when I saw one of his presentations. And he brought up the question, when is teaching not teaching? And when is not teaching teaching? And to me, it sounded a little bit like a whole bunch of different ideas that have come up tonight. But it was really, when you ask me that question about give it all or give it in little bite-sized chunks, it's about relinquishing control of the learning, which goes back to your Siemens statement. You know, it's all about. Them learning, not us standing there pretending to be teaching, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can do some of that when it's appropriate, but, you know, but basically that's what MOOCs are about, is giving people space to learn on their own and find other people that they can connect with in the, ideally, a MOOC massive. It has, should have at least 100 people in it.
Yeah.
Could be smaller than that, but. Still, you know, the idea is you've got people there with different goals, and you try to make a space where they can find each other and learn from each other.
Yeah, it goes
the teacher
back to
can
that.
Stand aside.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, didn't mean to bump into it. It goes back to that that adage about finding opportunities to get out of the way so that learning can take place.
Yeah. I teach a seminar on leadership, and I say to the students now, and I don't know if I – would have said this before the internet, but I say I read as much as I can possibly read about leadership, you know, continually. But I say to a class of 16 young women, you could all go down and search out the internet and find more in an afternoon than I know at all right now. And I hope you'll do that in whatever, this is like the beginning of a 2-year a year and a half or a 2-year seminar, which leads up to them writing their own dissertation on, you know, an undergrad level dissertation. And I said, I really want you guys to become semi-experts in some question or some area, and that you can right now based on everything that's out there and the collaboration that's available, the internet that's available, and 10 people have already done what you're looking to do. So go find them and, you know, get ideas. It's just endless out there. I'm feeling like you're breaking new ground here, Vance, that these teachers' room may become 90 minutes at some point is because we're just getting warmed up, it feels like. We got
through. Yeah.
But nice to hear questions from everyone else as well, if they have anything.
I'll stick around for that. I do have to get off pretty soon. I got dinner and stuff I got to take care of. But Jane and Mike and Iman and Hannah and Rhett and SS, if you have any questions.
Sure, grab a mic.
Yeah, grab the mic or type if you'd prefer to type.
I am looking at the chat now.
Yeah, either way.
So just while you're thinking about any questions and give chance to Vance to scan through the chat, just to let you know, there are three dots at the above the type message here to the right, and you can click on that and save the chat yourself if you want to. That's got all the links from today's session and some information in there.
Say again, where is that, Phil?
When you look at the chat box.
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Then right at the bottom, it says type message here.
Yeah.
But over to the right, and you'll
see three dots. Yeah.
If you click on that, then there's the option to save chat.
Wow. Wonderful Zoom, hey?
And
Zoom is quite brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. And then for anyone else who's not been to Teacher's Room before, then this is our collaborative online space for teacher development. We have kind of two different types of sessions. Tuesdays with Steve, and we have teacher stories, teacher interviews like today with special guest Vance Stevens. And then on Saturdays, we look at different topics of interest that are usually driven by the teachers who come. So we've done everything from looking at drama in the classroom to vocabulary, first 5 minutes of class, to kind of more theoretical ideas as well at times, but mostly practical. And the teacher's room, as Vance mentioned earlier, then we try and make sure that everybody can come in for a month for free to see how they like it. And then we just have a nominal fee to try and cover our costs, basically. Yeah. But we also have some special offers from time to time as well. And they go along with also our special courses and advanced courses as well to give people extra access.
Mm. Thank you, Phil.
All right.
I see a couple of questions there, Vance.
I see one from Mike. It's just the last one up. I might have missed a lot of questions, but he asked if I guess any of us have a face-to-face conference. So I tend to go to TESOL conferences year after year because that's where my network is. I'm not sure if that's my favorite conference because it's very large.
Yeah.
I really like the smaller conferences. I go to a Cal conference many years, the Cal Research Conference. They're the ones who awarded me Lifelong Learner. The Lifelong Achievement Award, for Cal this last year.
I had a friend who was nominated for that, and he said, it makes me feel too old. I still want to think I've got lots and lots ahead of me.
Yeah.
I'd rather be in my 80s when I'm offered something like that.
That's funny.
Hannah says she prefers IATEFL. I like IATEFL too. It does have a smaller feel to it, and a lot of my friends are there, and it's kind of more of a network. I network people at TESOL too, but that's so big, we tend to cluster. It's really a cluster there. So when I go to a TESOL conference, I forget the conference basically. I just go and work with the people I know. The conferences in Malaysia have been quite nice. Been able to meet a lot of people at them. I went to PELTA and ICCTAR in Malacca.
Uh-huh. There's another one coming up as well.
The MELTA?
Yeah, there's a research one, which is held near where I am now. And there's all the Asia ones as well in the region, which I hear good things about, like CAMTESOL.
Is talking about Thailand also. I've been to the Thailand one. It was good. Yeah, I've heard people say nice things about France, TESOL, and Greece.
Yeah, Greece, yeah, great. I heard good things about. Just quick question, actually. you'd like to share, Hannah and is it Imam, Jane, you said you're in Taiwan or something, then just wondered where everybody else was coming in from, because some of you mentioning times of day and so on, that would be good.
Jane is the author of the piece that I mentioned on vocabulary development in Minecraft.
Well, there you go.
Okay. And you'll be able to read that article in Tessel EJ 1st of November.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It's free.
Hmm. Okay. So Egypt and Korea.
Hmm. Well, I like to hear voices. If anybody wants to take a mic, this is probably your last chance. I can see Stephen looking very hungry there.
Yeah. We are a little bit over time today, but we have a grace period.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Sure.
Sorry.
This is Mike. Michael in Japan.
Kobe, yeah. I'm going to the World Polyglots Conference this weekend.
Cool.
And I was wondering, do you have, or does anybody have any questions they would ask polyglot learners?
Can you define for everybody the polyglot?
Oh, yeah, well, I guess I'll find out, but people who speak, well, multiple. At least multiple languages, and usually it means, seems to mean, they are quite quick learners.
Hmm.
But I don't know if everybody is. It doesn't seem like they're really strict about it or something.
Right.
Yeah, people are interested in speaking many languages, right? A lot of them speak like 5, 10, and so on. Steve Kaufman, is that right? Lingo Steve. I came across him.
I heard he's coming. Yeah,
and he has a YouTube channel. I was quite interested in. You are thinking about questions. I was interested actually from a polyglot's point of view, because a lot of polyglots learn languages without necessarily having a teacher, and so I wondered, you know, what's their perspective on the way languages are taught compared to how they found their learning experience. What has been most successful? When have they actually found a teacher to be useful?
Okay. Yeah, that's slightly different, but yeah, that's kind of why I'm going. I want to hear why they, in general, they don't seem to like teachers that much. And they have their own method, so I want to know. But okay, yeah, that's a good question.
There was a language teacher who, she's a polyglot, and she did a TEDx talk. I've forgotten her name, actually. And her TEDx talk is quite interesting. I really liked it as well. She was talking about being a polyglot and about some of the strategies and so on. If you've not seen that, I'll try and dig that up for you during the week. And that would be my...
Yeah. And I was going to say, I always go to TESOL conferences too, so I'm kind of excited to go to some... It's not teachers. It's something a little bit different.
Right.
So I'm kind of excited just to kind of mix it up a little bit.
Cool.
And thanks to the internet, Mike, I can give you the link and everyone else here. This is the TEDx talk I mentioned. So it's a good one. It's good for teachers as well.
Hmm. Okay. Make sure we save that.
Quick like a bunny, Phil.
I was going to just say that it's axiomatic that people love to learn, but they hate to be taught.
Oh, there's another one. Nice one.
I can't remember where I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah. Maybe it's a question of patience sometimes, too.
Hmm. Well, anybody else before I wrap us up here? Happy to stay as long as we have questions. If anybody has another question for Vance or for the room in general. So I'm going to scroll back just a little bit.
Okay. Otherwise, our next session in the teacher's room will be on Saturday, the 26th, next Saturday, at 1 a.m. GMT, which is Saturday morning. We're in Southeast Asia. And then back here on Tuesday, 2 weeks from now, at the same time.
You see, Hannah's question on what's your take on homeschooling? That's another hour.
That's what I was thinking. Talking about that and talking about that over the last couple of years too. It's a good topic.
Well, Phil, with three little kids and you know, very expensive international school rates around Malaysia, do you have any? Where is your brain at on homeschooling right now?
I've thought about it. kids are in like regular school, primary school, but yeah, sometimes you think about what type of schooling they have and what kind of experiences they have, plus and minus.
Yeah.
I think generally homeschooling requires a lot of very dedicated parents with time available. Most good homeschooling experiences that I've heard of from parents is basically they've dedicated their lives to homeschooling their kids and their other net homeschoolers network kids. So they share it around themselves, but those are the key things.
Is this in your wheelhouse, Vance?
I've come across it in reading about Minecraft, where it's figures into some homeschooling and also coding when I'm reading about coding. Of course, there's the social problem, the social, you know, you have to make sure you have, they don't miss out on the social life that, obviously if you're living, I mean, it's a big thing in parts of Canada where they're remote, but then they have, oh, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Australia. But they, it's probably in Canada too, but they, you know, they have networks. They tend to have networks with other people homeschooling. So there's homeschooling networks. But, I think if you're fortunate, then you've got good schools you can send your kids to. I think that my wife and I had never considered it for our children because we didn't really have, there wasn't a, there's no shootings in schools here, you know, so you don't have crime and people stealing things. So, well, I mean, we grew up in the, our kids grew up in Oman and California. California was kind of worse, but they'd already pretty much got through their school in Oman. So we were fortunate. So it didn't really become an issue.
Yeah, it's funny because you've just taken in your answer, you've taken a somewhat position of as a response to, you know, negativity in the schools might be one reason to do it versus when I first read about it, I heard the amount that a student actually learns in content equals about something like 7 days of intense study or, you know, I mean, it's just... it's stretched out so painfully. Right. And if you happen to be a very curious parent and lucky enough to have curious children, they can whiz through a year's worth of material literally in weeks.
Yeah, our neighbors that I spoke to where we used to live before, they said that basically their kids covered what they needed to cover in about 2 to 3 hours. So then they were free for the rest of the day. So they would do like museum trips to art galleries and other stuff with other kids and so on, or do picnics, nature walks. And they actually thought their kids were getting a much richer life out of it. And then they were with networks of people. They didn't have bullying issues to deal with and so on. So
yeah,
all sounded pretty good.
But you see, Hannah here has explained that she's prepping for a debate in 2 days. This house argues that we should abolish schools and universities and study from home. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I don't know about the word abolish, but I mean that should be an option.
Yeah.
People. Right. So I guess in the United States, I believe they require kids to go to school. I'm not sure how you get out of that, but.
Right.
So, you know.
And that's certainly protection for some kids that might not be given the opportunity to go to school. I think that should be an inalienable right.
There are online schools as well, like completely online. I heard a talk from a guy who set up an online school, and he said, you know, we actually have students, not necessarily they've been bullied or anything else, but for example, they had one student had an injury, and she was basically off school for half a year, and so joined the school so she can continue her studies and so forth. And
yeah,
they see that as an expanding area, so it's quite interesting to see what the alternative options are.
I notice Anna has said that statements in debates need to be strong, and certainly Vance picked up on that word abolish, which has a lot of loaded meaning in it. But it's true, yeah. When my son is very much into debating, and all of the statements are meant to be provocative to some degree. So, thanks for mentioning that, Anna.
Yeah.
When all righty, everybody. I think with that, we'll wrap it up here, but if you like what you saw tonight, apparently Vance is going to invite us back to his side of the camera next time. Do we have a date fixed or not yet?
No, I think it was you've got a conference you're putting on, Jolt, is that it?
Yeah, Jolt.
So you,
sometime after that, hey?
Yeah, Phil said find a time after that.
Okay, well, let's pick a date and we'll make sure we promote it here and you promote it on your end. And
I'll put the PB Works, the learningtogether.pbworks address here.
Yeah.
So you can find where it will be.
Thank you very much.
Well, next time, Phil's been inviting me a number of times to get over to KL, which I'd love to do, and I would love to try to work it so we take a little side trip up to Penang, or
why not?
Have that iced tea together.
Yeah. And anyone else, if you find yourself in Malaysia, give us a holler.
Yeah.
I see you're onto my secrets here. You're onto my tricks. Although you know something, these frosted glasses are really good for iced tea. I often actually do drink iced tea from these.
Good. Nice.
It just happens to be the wrong time of night for iced tea.
I see. Okay. All righty. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. Me too.
Likewise.
Okay.
Recording.
Let me just grab the chat.
Oh.
Yes. I got it. Okay.
Okay.
Did I put the last thing in here?
Okay. All the links to the PB Work stuff I put earlier on in the chat anyway. So
okay.
Yeah, if you want it.
Now I'm gonna turn off the recording.